Hey, Up First listeners, it's Sunday and we have a new episode for you. This summer, when Minneapolis police officers killed George Floyd, everything seemed to change, or a lot of things anyway. Protesters around the world demanded justice, and over again they said the names of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery. NPR sat down with their families and their friends to learn more about who these folks were, and over the next three Sundays, we're going to be playing those stories. Today, what lit the match? Elsa Chang and Rachel Martin have this report.
This is a special report from NPR News, Summer of Racial Reckoning. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Rachel Martin. May 25th, 2020, Memorial Day. 2 months into the coronavirus pandemic, the U.S. was in crisis. Tens of thousands dead, large parts of the country locked down, offices, schools, stores, restaurants, churches, all closed. Millions had lost their jobs.
Then, just before 8 o'clock that Monday evening in Minneapolis, a 46-year-old black man named George Floyd stepped into Cup Foods convenience store to buy cigarettes. And just a warning, this audio is hard to listen to.
Please, I can't breathe. Please, man.
George Floyd on the ground. A white Minneapolis police officer kneeling on him. Nearly 9 minutes passed, the officer pressing his knee into Floyd's neck the whole time until Floyd passes out and later is pronounced dead. It was all captured on video and it spread online instantly, igniting outrage and activism. Starting with the crowd who gathered there on that street corner during the standoff between George Floyd and police, the crowd begging the police to let up.
Look at him.
He's not responsive right now, bro. No, bro, look at him. He's not responsive right now, bro.
Check for a pulse.
Bro, are you serious?
Then the first crowd started to gather in Minneapolis, protesting Floyd's death at the hands of their police force.
Overnight, Minneapolis on fire. Protesters leaving an auto parts store in flames. Others seen looting a local Target. All of it after demonstrators approached one of the city's police precincts.
We're about to lose the front of the precinct if we don't move this crowd out of the front.
And as video of Floyd's encounter with police and news of his death spread, so did the outrage and the demonstrations.
Say his name!
In downtown L.A., a support rally this evening by Black Lives Matter near the Hall of Justice began peacefully.
Twitter flagged one of President Trump's tweets about Minneapolis earlier today, saying it glorified violence. Trump's tweet read, quote, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." The tweet on the president's personal account was hidden.
Peacefully assembling. The NYPD began to aggressively, look at as we're even speaking, we're watching them aggressively. Look at what he's doing to this woman. Stop it!
Four Minneapolis police officers involved in the arrest of a black man who died in custody have been fired.
In this three-part special report from NPR News, we're going to look back at the events of this summer. We'll hear more about the life of George Floyd and also about the lives of Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, two other black people whose tragic deaths led to a rallying cry for change.
In part two, we'll hear how systemic racism has shaped American institutions, including the police.
And in part three, we'll hear how things are starting to change. Confederate statues coming down, cities committing to rethinking police budgets, and how there is still a long way to go.
But to know where we're headed, we have to understand how we got here. And one thing is for sure, this all began long before George Floyd was killed by a police officer in front of a convenience store on Memorial Day. Karen Grigsby-Bates is a senior correspondent for NPR's Code Switch podcast, and she's with me now to talk more about the broader context of this moment. Karen, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Rachel.
So George Floyd is a name attached to a long list of names of black men killed by police in this country. Before Floyd, there was Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Philando Castile. The list goes on and on. Each of those felt like, in isolation, they could have been a moment for change. Why didn't that happen at all those different points in time?
We in black and brown communities around the country saw that and said, oh, wow. And sadly, it wasn't something that was unfamiliar to us. I think other people who've had different lived experiences, especially in terms of their interactions with police, looked at it and thought, well, these guys must have done something wrong, you know, because otherwise, why would the police react that way? And I think it took a while for these incidences to pile up, for all of a sudden somebody saying, maybe there's something else happening here.
And this was about white people seeing this happen in a new way to a certain degree, right? I mean, there was the video and a very intimate look at a man's life ending.
With George Floyd, you saw from the beginning to the end. And I think part of what made this a tipping point for the nation, as opposed to just communities within the nation, was that we were able to see the officer's knee on Floyd's neck. We saw him getting sort of fainter and fainter, him gasping, you know, I can't breathe, while his hands were in his pocket. This is the thing that people would say to me over and over again when I would ask them about this. It's like, this is what our lives mean to them. And so the them, obviously, is police.
I mean, what were your thoughts, Karen, and conversations with your own friends and family?
You know, people sort of universally said, no matter their race or their gender or their age, the one thing that they kept saying was, that made me sick to watch it. The second thing some people said was, I knew what was on that tape, but I couldn't watch it because it was just too triggering. But the people who actually saw it often saw it more than once, because they just couldn't believe what they were seeing. And a lot of us felt physically ill.
What about your conversations with white colleagues or white friends?
They were physically ill too. And I think that's what made it a tipping point, that with George Floyd, all of a sudden everybody was seeing it all at once, at the same time. There was no editing of the tape. And it was hugely disturbing to people who had not had hostile interactions with the police.
So the protests started, right, in Minneapolis after George Floyd's death. And then they were seemingly everywhere. You know, you think back to Ferguson, Missouri, and Michael Brown's death, and the protests that happened there. And there were national protests around that, but not nearly the same way that we have seen the protests erupt around America this summer. Why, do you think?
3.5 years of unrelieved social division, racial division, class division that have, a lot of people feel, been stoked at the top from leadership in the White House, has done its work. And so all this tension and all this animosity, that's partially why people just realized, we have to fix this or the whole thing's going to blow up.
There's obviously another element to these protests, right? A pandemic that is affecting black and brown people much harder than it is white people, frankly.
Yeah, it is.
And this is how Kianga Yamada Taylor, a professor of African American studies at Princeton, connected the pandemic to George Floyd's killing the week after.
The idea that the richest country in the history of the world cannot get people face masks, cannot ensure that people will not be thrown out of their houses, cannot ensure that people will be fed, is an abomination. And so for me, the events over the last week have shown that people are, even in the midst of this pandemic and social distancing and self-isolation, are going to fight for a different kind of reality. And the struggle on the streets has to be turned into organizing, has to be turned into a set of achievable demands. But it begins with resisting the status quo and letting it be known that we're not all just going to lay down and die.
I mean, what do you make of that, Karen?
Well, I'm thinking that the pandemic, as a lot of people have said, emphasize the social inequities that already existed in our society. And one of the things it did was make the protests that are going on now bigger than just policing. They want a lot of the social inequities in this country corrected. They want better health care for everybody, no matter what they look like. They want better education, no matter where they live or what they look like. They've happened piecemeal, but not as a unified whole. And I think that's why a lot of people persist in the streets.
The Reverend Al Sharpton talked about these very ideas, these inequities, these structural imbalances when he spoke at George Floyd's memorial service. And I want to play a long clip of his remarks from that day. Let's listen.
We were smarter than the underfunded schools you put us in, but you had your knee on our neck. We could run corporations and not hustle in the street, but you had your knee on our neck. We had creative skills. We could do whatever anybody else could do, but we couldn't get your knee off our neck. What happened to Floyd happens every day in this country, in education, in health services, and in every area of American life. It's time for us to stand up in George's name and say, get your knee off our necks.
I mean, this is so much of what this is about, right? America acknowledging, waking up, whatever verb you want to use, to the fact that this is not isolated, that this is a tragedy, what happened to George Floyd, but it represents day-to-day injustices against Black and brown people.
When George Floyd's funeral was televised, it's like, wow, you know, he just sort of put it all out there in very stark language that should be easy enough for even the most indifferent person to hear and understand.
Karen, thanks. We really appreciate the conversation and the context.
You're welcome.
George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery. Those were the names that protesters were chanting on the streets after Floyd was killed by a Minneapolis police officer. We wanted to learn more about their lives, who they were, what they cared about, and the people who loved and cared for them. George Floyd's memorial services drew huge crowds, first in Minneapolis, then in his home state of Texas.
Well, when I saw three officers holding a Black man down and him screaming, "Mama," and "I can't breathe," and no one will help him, it sickened me, and I felt like it was time for me to take a stand.
Seeing that technique being done on someone that was handcuffed, he was not putting up a fight, he was actually pleading his case, it hurt.
It broke my heart. I ain't slept since it happened. I've been out here. I ain't going nowhere.
They don't know our neighborhood. This is our neighborhood. This is where we growed up at. That crushed me when I seen that, because that could have been me, my brother, my father, anybody.
George Floyd was somebody's father and brother. His brother, Felonese, spoke at the memorial in Minneapolis.
Everybody loved George. We didn't call him George. We called him Perry. If you called him Perry, you knew him direct, you know what I mean? Because George was the name everybody called him, Big George, Big Floyd. You know, Georgie Porgy. He had so many different names.
George Floyd had only called Minneapolis home for a few years. Home was Houston. Morning Edition host David Green visited his hometown to learn more about the life of George Floyd.
To tell Floyd's story, you really have to come here. We're in the heart of Houston's Third Ward. You literally feel George Floyd looking down on you. His face is on a mural on the side of a small grocery store. There's a halo above his head with the words "Texas Made, Third Ward Raised." People have been gathering here in a small park nearly nonstop. People like Crystal Hewitt, who knew Floyd's family.
Is this always a gathering place, this
We always gather right here.
Over here?
Yeah.
She tells us about all the other names on this wall, people the community has lost.
These are people you know a lot of these names, don't you?
I know everybody on this wall. Everybody on this wall is from this neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Some of them are here for, like, natural causes. Some of them are here from death by drive-by shootings. But this is our family. So it's like the ghetto angels of our family. These are the people who's looking down on us to help us.
Your nephew's on here, you said?
My nephew's on here. My cousin's on here.
Can I ask how they died?
My nephew passed away by, he got shot. My cousin got shot. My friend, see, Tristan, drive-by shooting. Just a child.
And now George Floyd is on this wall in a prominent place.
Because he's the OG. He's the OG of this neighborhood. He always used to tell the younger version of us to try to stay out of trouble, try to do better things. He left Houston to try to better himself. And for him to leave Houston to better himself to get killed, I mean, I don't feel like that was like, it was crazy. It was heartbreaking to me because he taught us a lot. He's older than me, so I'm 44, so, and he taught us a lot. You know, for me to see him on national TV pass away like that, that hurt.
What did he teach you?
You know, the streets is not for the bees. You know, we get out here, we jump out of the porch young. We try to follow in the older people's footsteps, selling drugs, doing other things. He says not for us. A woman's place is to be doing work and doing other things. A young man is supposed to be trying to look for a job to take care of their family. And that's what he was trying to do, take care of his family. He was always a family man.
If you walk a few blocks from the little market, you're in CUNY Homes. It's a public housing community. Residents fondly call it the Bricks. The buildings are all two stories made of bricks, surrounding a basketball court where much of life plays out. Floyd used to shoot hoops here. He would also drag tubs out onto the court to baptize neighbors with his church.
The Bricks, it's hard. It's hard.
This is Eddie Barlow, who grew up here and now teaches English and coaches basketball at Yates High School, where Floyd went to school.
95% of these kids either living with an aunt, a grandmother, or a single parent. You know, because their fathers are either on drugs, in prison, can't get work, have felonies. It's hard.
And this was George Floyd's world. At the memorial in Minneapolis, Floyd's brother said the family didn't have much. They would sleep in the same beds. They'd make mayonnaise banana sandwiches together. But George Floyd and his mom, Cece, who worked at a fast food spot in the neighborhood, are remembered for helping the community however they could. We were talking here on the court the other day with two people who knew Floyd, Xavier Roberson and Stephanie Square. Xavier said he remembered as a boy, if he had no money, he would always look for Floyd to be walking through here, and Floyd would never say no. He'd give him a dollar or two.
A lot of these kids get their meals when they go to school. And so that was one reason that I couldn't work out like I wanted to coming from school, because I got to find my next meal. You know, I'm trying to get some money some kind of way.
Can I ask you about his mom? Because a lot of people, I feel like, would love to know who she was and what she was like.
She had a hamburger stand. And she
what do you fed. Remember about it?
And that's where we went. We got home.
When we had enough money,
$3.
We knew we can eat there. Mm-hmm.
For a fact.
We knew we could eat there.
And we ate. Like.
And you know, sometimes we would tell Mrs. C, we'll pay you next week or tomorrow, and she'd be okay with it, even if we didn't.
It sounds like he and his mom were really important to this community.
They were part of the village. When they say it takes a village, they were part of the village. They raised us. You know, and we were the lucky ones.
And it wasn't just money and food. Floyd would tell younger kids at every chance to try to stay out of trouble.
He was always encouraging. I actually was very surprised when I started seeing my former students posting messages of encouragement that he sent them. And I thought to myself, wow, he never stopped. All he did was encourage everyone and to tell you words like, I'm so proud of you. You're going to make it. You're going to be an example to a lot of others. I think that's his legacy, and that's what we try to do, is to just continue to give back and do the same thing, encourage the younger ones.
What's really interesting is that friends who knew George Floyd more recently as an adult here bring up the same thing. Even two decades later, after Floyd played some college basketball in Florida and then made his way back to Houston to help his mom, he was still telling kids in the Bricks to stay on the right path. But now he was drawing on years more experience. Nigelon Dunn was with other friends gathered on the basketball court here the other day to reflect on
Went
Floyd's life.
Went through the trials in life that comes from systemic injustice. I mean, look at where we're standing at, right? You know, where poverty is real. And so I think he, you know, he lived a life where every stereotype, you know, that's placed upon a black man coming from poverty and in the city, all those things are real. Yeah, he had a criminal record. Yeah, he did time in jail. But when I met him, it was on the other side of that. The George that I met was a man who had all the stripes and had all the scars and the scratches and the war wounds, and who could speak from a place of experience and say, you know, for the 14, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, hey, this isn't the way. Like, I've walked down this path, this isn't the way. So the George Floyd that I met was an advocate for change. And like I've continued to say, yeah, there is a criminal record. There is time served in jail. Shouts out to the district attorneys who prosecuted him. Shouts out to the judges who dropped the gavel. Shouts out to all them. The system worked. And, you know, in this case, we're just continuing to ask for the system to work again.
In recent years, Floyd became a lot more involved in church. He was seen as sort of a gatekeeper for the neighborhood. Pastors and aid groups could only come into the Bricks to help people if they had Floyd's blessing. The Christian hip-hop musician Corey Paul, who got to know Floyd, says Floyd's decision a few years back to move to Minneapolis was grounded in his faith.
He went to Minnesota to progress his life through a Christian ministry for job placements and learning how to drive trucks. And, you know, it was a intentional move. Like Pete been saying, you don't come from areas we're from, black, and go to Minnesota just to hang out. You know what I'm saying? You're going there for a reason. And for George's reason, it was to better his life even more.
Now many people are searching for something deeper as they grieve.
And I think somehow the Lord is allowing it to transcend amongst people. And I believe it's just because it's true, man. Like, regardless of what people try to say, you talk to 100 people that know him, you will know he was a walking, living, you know, sacrifice. And I feel like God is allowing people to see that.
Floyd's death, of course, has led to nationwide protests, calls for policing in America to change, raw conversations about race and discrimination. Here on the basketball court in the Bricks the other day, it's also led to this.
Is that the first one to take pictures?
Here, square. Hold on.
You want to hear? Well, you do your thing.
Yeah, let's go. We're taking pictures and everything. Let's go. What's your name?
People who knew Floyd had set up tables right on the court to register new voters.
Because coming from where we come from, to be honest, I don't think there was even a conversation about how important voting was.
That's Eddie Barlow, again, the high school teacher. He was working on this voter drive with Xavier Roberson.
How do you tie his killing to wanting to do this today?
If I can be completely honest with you, racism. Getting people out of position of power that not for all people, only for a select few amount of people. That's like the root of it, you know? If you can get somebody in office that's for all people, then we won't have these problems. Police will be accountable, you know? Police will be held accountable for situations like this. So I think this is one of the next steps that we could do to help, you know? It may be small to some people, but it's big for us.
This basketball court, the mural of Floyd over at the market, have become spaces for almost round-the-clock vigils, places to reflect. Crystal Hewitt comes here to the mural each day when she checks on her mom, who lives in the Bricks.
My mother is 65, so she's been out here her entire life.
Wow. She do okay through the pandemic and everything?
Oh, yeah. Most definitely. I'm going to make sure she's going to be. I go every day and check on her.
Have you and your mom talked about the killing of George Floyd?
The thing that me and my mom talked about, she said when she seen him call for his mother, his mom was coming to get him. And because that's when he took his last breath, when he called for his mama. That means she was coming for him. So that's hurtful. I don't know how other people feel. I'm just sick of it. I've never been racist in my life, and I'm just sick of it. I love people in general, not people of color. I love people. And to see so many people come out here to show love to him, it's nice. It's,
What's
I'm trying not to cry. You know
no,
what I'm saying?
I you're allowed to cry as much as you want.
I know. It's just hurtful.
George Floyd and his mom are to be buried side by side.
That was NPR's David Greene. Before George Floyd called out for his mother as he lay dying, before he was buried next to her, before protesters took up his cause and the cause of police brutality directed at minorities, there was Ahmaud Arbery. Arbery went for a jog on a late winter day in suburban Georgia, and during that jog, the 25-year-old was shot and killed after being chased by three white men, one a former police officer. All Things Considered host Mary Louise Kelly spoke with Associated Press race and ethnicity reporter Aaron Morrison to learn more about the life of Ahmaud Arbery.
Start by describing for us the neighborhood, the community that Ahmaud Arbery lived in. How long had his family been there?
His family had been there for as early as his peewee football days. If you wanted, you know, a description of the town, it's a predominantly black town surrounded by predominantly white subdivisions and other communities, more suburban or more affluent. Right. And so where we find Ahmaud here is Brunswick Home, mm-hmm. into a subdivision known as Satilla Shores. And that's where he encounters the two men that would profile him as a burglar and kill him.
Who are charged with shooting him. Yeah. Well, take us back to those peewee football days. His family told you that he was a shy kid growing up, reserved. They worried he never went out. Did they talk about how he came out of his shell?
They talked about he really coming into his own as he started in his early teens to late teens, started to think about what he wanted out of his life. And, you know, he at one point wanted to turn his love of football and sports into a career in the NFL. And that's not something that panned out, really. His coach told me that, you know, he wasn't a shoe-in for a linebacker, even on the junior varsity squad of his high school. But he showed a lot of heart and still managed to play 4 years on his high school football team.
The high school football coach, Jason Vaughn, I gather was his name, mm-hmm. also said that Arbery had a pretty good sense of humor, that he did a good imitation of his coach.
Well, multiple people that I spoke to talked about Ahmaud's personality. His mother said he was the life of the party, but then also too, his coach says that he had this real ability to sense when, you know, his coach wasn't having a great day. And so he'd go, go stand next to him in the hallway and sort of imitate him and tell other students to get to class and don't be tardy, don't be late. And the coach, that Jason Vaughn, said that was really the way that Ahmaud showed care for other people.
It sounds like people were pretty open with you that Arbery had some rough patches. He'd had a couple of run-ins with the law in 2013 and 2017. There was probation for bringing a gun to high school grounds. There was a shoplifting charge. But his lawyer, Lee Merritt, told you that Arbery was at a point of transition. What do we know about that? What was he planning for the future?
Well, his mother has three brothers, and he wanted to become an electrician like his uncles. And so he had gone to take some college courses to begin making the transition into becoming an electrician. But he decided to take a break sometime within the last year. And that time would allow him to finish his term of probation for the charges that he pled guilty to in his late teens, early 20s.
Right. Aaron Morrison, he is a race and ethnicity reporter for the Associated Press, telling us a little bit there about the life of Ahmaud Arbery. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Arbery was shot and killed back in February. It took more than 2 months before anyone was charged with his killing. NPR's Michelle Martin spoke to Benjamin Krupp, an attorney who has represented the families of several Black people who were killed by police.
What's your role in this case? Why does his family need a lawyer?
Certainly. The reason, Michelle, his family needs lawyers is a reason that is underscored by this very case. The fact that Ahmaud Arbery was executed in broad daylight and that prosecutors had video of the lynching, but yet the prosecutors failed to act on this probable cause that they could see with their own eyes. And so black people and brown people and people who are marginalized and disenfranchised have to turn to advocates. His mother and father were begging and pleading for somebody to be held accountable for the murder of their child. But yet, the prosecutor told them no charges are to be filed. And so the family needed advocates. They needed people who understood the law. Because as you know, we're officers of the court. And they needed somebody to say, this isn't right.
That was NPR's Michelle Martin. Coming up, another police killing on the other side of the country leads to more protests. Breonna Taylor was a paramedic. She was shot and killed by police in her own home. That's after a short break.
Black voters play a crucial role for any Democrat who seeks to win the White House. But some big divides amongst that bloc, and some serious ambivalence, could determine who is elected president this November. Listen now on the Code Switch podcast from NPR.
This is a special report from NPR News, Summer of Racial Reckoning. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This moment we're in began with the death of George Floyd, but it didn't take long for Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor, both of whom were killed before George Floyd was, to also become symbols of violence against Black people.
Breonna Taylor, the 26-year-old emergency room technician, was shot and killed in her apartment by Louisville police on March 13th. It took weeks for her case to catch the nation's attention, and even now, no arrests have been made in her killing. All Things Considered host Ari Shapiro went to Louisville to find out more about Breonna Taylor, who she was before she became a symbol of police violence. He talked to some of the people who knew her best.
That's my little mini-me.
Your little mini-me is what you call it?
I said Tamika had her with that. She was all mine. Aww.
Breonna's aunt, Bianca Austin, invited us to her home, along with another aunt, Tahasha Holloway, and an uncle, Tyrone Bell.
I called her Breezy.
Well, he called her Breezy.
Breezy.
She's cool. She's a cool cat.
And we also visited two of her best friends since high school, Erinika Hunter and Shatanis Vaughn.
We met Breonna sophomore year.
Well, I met Breonna through you.
Yeah. So
she introduced us.
So it was me, then her. And we've been inseparable ever since.
Yeah, three amigos.
That's what we called ourselves, the three amigos, literally. Yeah.
And collectively, her friends and family gave us the unvarnished picture of Breonna.
The laugh, her laugh, and her voice. She's got like this baby whiny kind of voice. Like, she's like,
oh my goodness, I don't know, y'all don't understand. Like...
So you definitely know, like, when we mock her, like, you'll know who it was if you knew her.
Breonna Taylor loved old music from the 80s and 90s, card games with family.
Let's play some FaceTime and listen to some music.
Okay, what was her favorite game?
Skip on FaceTime.
And singing.
Last $2. Oh, she's going to sing that to the top of her lungs. Like.
Oh, so she liked to sing?
She couldn't.
Her friends told us the same thing about her cooking. She loved to do it, but...
She couldn't cook.
She couldn't cook.
She can cook.
She can fry food.
That's cooking.
Oh, see, she can't cook either.
Cook a little bit. Her favorite food was chicken. She fried some good chicken.
Yeah, she did fry some chicken. But that's
her
it.
Best dish.
Like I said, this is the unvarnished picture. A lot of Breonna Taylor's extended family moved from Michigan to Kentucky, a few at a time over the years. She came to Louisville as a teenager and fit right in.
Breonna
loved it
here.
Oh, she absolutely. To this day, she loved it in Louisville, Kentucky. Yes.
She absolutely loved it here. Like, everything about it.
When did you first know that she wanted to go into medical work and help people?
I think
she's always had a caring heart.
It was just in her nature to just take care of people.
So I got this Facebook post that she made for me last year when I had a stroke. And I don't know, it just like, I saved it and everything. Like, it just really touched me. But she said, working in healthcare is so rewarding. It makes me feel so happy when I know I've made a difference in someone else's life. I'm so appreciative of all the staff that has helped my uncle throughout this difficult time and those that will continue to make a difference in his life. Keep pushing, T-Bill. You got this, Unc. With that attitude and determination, I'm positive you'll recover in no time. Love you. And it's just...
That says so, so much about her.
Right, it do. It say a lot about her. Like, and that's her. Like, that's her all the way.
Last year, her friend Erinika Hunter had brain surgery. She and Brianna had drifted apart at that point, and Brianna showed up at the hospital to reminisce with her about old times.
And, oh gosh, this is hard. And I'm like, well, why do we fall out? I don't understand. She was like, it doesn't matter, Neek. We together again, you know. Don't worry about that. I love you. Just know that we here. You here.
But she's she not was. Here.
She's not here at all. And it's not right. I feel like we was robbed.
Neighbors near PRP say they woke up to chaos, sounds of breaking glass, gunshots, and sirens. Earlier
today, we know the outlines of how Brianna Taylor died. Police doing a narcotics investigation burst into her apartment in the middle of the night with a no-knock warrant. Her boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, thought someone was breaking in and shot an officer in the leg. Police shot up the apartment, killing Brianna. They arrested her boyfriend. There was no body cam footage. Kenneth has since been released, and the charges against him dropped. When all that first happened in mid-March, the initial news reports told only one side of the story, referring to Brianna Taylor and Kenneth Walker only as suspects. This was from the local NBC affiliate.
A video of a deadly exchange of gunfire that happened between officers and suspects early this morning.
One suspect is dead. An officer is recovering after...
And when her family saw those stories...
I was angry. I was so angry. Oh, my gosh. It still pisses me off. Just suspect. Like, seriously? Unbelievable.
When I read that article, I probably said more cuss words in that little time than I said throughout my whole life. Like, angry is an understatement. Like, that is an understatement.
They think this first narrative of Brianna as a suspect could be one reason, on top of COVID-19, that most of the mortuaries they called refused to take her.
You know, that was part of the reason, like, people were turning us away. Like, you know, we're calling these churches and, you know, mortuaries, and they're like, it's just the young lady, this the incident, you know, that they, and I'm like, you know, yes, and, oh, we'll get back with you and stuff like that. And it was unbelievable.
And they didn't even know our name.
Attorney Lonita Baker has been representing the family since even before Brianna Taylor's funeral. She's a personal injury lawyer who used to work as a prosecutor. The family hired her to file a suit against the police, and they're also pushing for policy changes around body cams and no-knock warrants. She went to Brianna's apartment as soon as she was allowed to.
Even in being a prosecutor, I had never quite seen that many bullets in one apartment. To know and to see that bullets went through neighboring apartments as well. Afterwards, in talking to Kenny, when he told me where he was and he was laying on the floor right next to Brianna, it's only a supreme being that, a supreme reason that he's still alive and able to talk to us about it. And I do think that that reason is that we needed someone to tell us the story of what happened so that we could get the change that is needed.
So when protesters today say her name, Brianna's family and friends say they feel lifted up. At the same time, they have complicated feelings about the person they love becoming a larger-than-life figure in death.
Is it weird to share your best friend with millions of people you've never met?
Yes.
Yes. It makes me jealous a little bit. Yes.
Like, you don't even know her.
Seriously. Why?
But it's wonderful. It's a blessing all in the same. Like, thank you for, you know, acknowledging her and, you know, and loving her just off of what you think. But I actually knew her, you know.
Let's make that clear.
She blessed my life. You don't know.
Brianna's aunts and uncle are still wrapping their heads around the fact that their niece, who they have known her whole life, is now a symbol, a hashtag.
You never would think that her name would be added to a list.
A hashtag,
or, you know, now you write and say her name. You just think, like, how? Like, why is she even part of it? How does this happen? Like,
And in a sense, we're grateful that her name is at where she should be, you know, unfortunately, in this situation. But, you know, we don't want this at all. We want her back. Like, I'd rather just go back in time. Like,
yeah,
just crazy.
Do you think something good will come of this?
I hope so.
I'm praying to God. I said, we need real change in America. Because it's scary. It's like, I got to still raise a little black boy here in this world we live in.
Yeah.
Anybody. Nobody's safe. If this can happen to Brianna, it can happen to anybody.
Erinika Hunter was going through Brianna's things after her death and found something she hadn't seen in years. A scrapbook page that Brianna made in high school, memorializing their friendship.
This is our senior page from our scrapbook.
So the two of you in like a bunch of different photos together. And then what does it say here in the corner?
Erinika is like the sister the same age as me that I've always wanted. She is the one who is always there right beside me when I need her.
Erinika sets the page and the tiny urn with some of Brianna's ashes next to each other on her kitchen table.
Yeah, so her ashes. I know people think I'm so weird because, like, sometimes when I need a drink, I sit and prop it up just like this. And I talk to her ashes.
Across town, there's another image of Brianna. It's a portrait drawn in chalk at the center of the protest in downtown Louisville. People gather in a circle around it, chanting.
Brianna Taylor! Brianna Taylor! Brianna Taylor! Brianna Taylor!
She always said that she would be a legend. I just never imagined it would be like this.
Is that true? She said that?
Yeah. I'm going to be one of the greats. I'm going to be a legend. Y'all going to remember me.
That was NPR's Ari Shapiro talking to the friends and family of Brianna Taylor.
We've been hearing about George Floyd, Brianna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery because of nationwide protests and the calls for change these three people inspired. The protests began in Minneapolis the night that George Floyd died. Then they continued into the next night and the night after that.
George Floyd!
Say his name!
George Floyd!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
And they spread across the country into Los Angeles, Louisville, and Atlanta. Weekend Edition Sunday host Lulu Garcia Navarro spoke to some of the people called to action.
Here in D.C., there were multiple demonstrations. This national movement has drawn in many young people who are finding their voice for the first time.
So a tweet was sent out by our founder. She was like, does anybody want to do a protest? And I was just like, sure. And I thought that it was just going to be a collective of maybe 10 people just going outside and just holding each other accountable. But it's spiraled into something much, much bigger, as we can see.
Kerrigan Williams is 22. She's from Houston. She's a graduate student at Georgetown University. And when she saw that tweet,
I just felt something activate in me, like, okay, this is hitting too close to home right now.
She actually knew George Floyd. They came from the same community in Houston.
He was really, really close to a few of my friends that I went to college with. One of my cousins was his football coach. So I'm in this moment because being from that community, it could be my cousin. It could be the guy that I see at the corner store all the time. It could be anybody.
Or it could have been her when she was a student at Sam Houston State University.
I was walking in a residential neighborhood in Huntsville, Texas, right by my apartment building in college, and the police followed me the whole walk. the whole walk, just walking through the neighborhood, just trying to get some fresh air before I go back to sleep or go back to class or go back to work, they followed me the whole time. I didn't want to go home because I didn't want them to know, like, you know, where I lived. But I went home, got in my car, and drove back to Houston. That same officer followed me all the way back to Houston, which is a 45-minute drive.
And she says every single Black person she knows has a story like that, or much worse.
It just made me feel kind of dehumanized. I know that that is just an experience for all Black folks when I say that, that you just feel subpar, subhuman, and feel like you have to be watched with everything that you do. Even taking a walk in the park, you just have to be surveilled. And it just makes you feel like you aren't worthy of just living a normal life without being surveilled by the police.
That was Georgetown University graduate student Kerrigan Williams talking to NPR's Lulu Garcia Navarro about what moved her to join the demonstrations.
The protests aren't limited to big cities. They're happening in towns as small as Bethel, Ohio, and protesters are getting a mixed reception. Lulu Garcia Navarro talked with one organizer there.
My name is Alicia G, and I'm one of the co-organizers for the demonstration that happened in Bethel last Sunday.
Bethel is a town of fewer than 3,000 people, and nearly all the residents are white. G said she's always believed in the Black Lives Matter movement, and when she saw protests happening in other small towns, she thought it was time to have one in hers. I asked her, how did it go?
We made a Facebook post in our little town's Facebook group. Very quickly, the other side kind of rose up. They were like, you can't come into my town and you've got to protect it. And this narrative of us being an outsider coming in and to destroy the town really took hold. And then about an hour before we were due to start, we found out that where we were originally going to be standing was filled with just like motorcycle gangs and people with guns and just people who did not want us to be there.
There were around 800 counter-demonstrators. That's according to Bethel Police. So G's group of about 80 people moved a few blocks away, but it wasn't long until the counter-protesters found them and gathered across the street.
Then a swarm of them came across the street at us and kind of surrounded us and were yelling, calling everyone all the names you could imagine they would call us. There was some pushing and there was sign snatching and ripping them up. And it became very clear that we had to get out of there very fast. It was very scary.
Alicia G headed for her car, parked some distance away, but she soon came upon more trouble.
One of our high school demonstrators that was with us was being herded by like probably 10 big men. And she's like less than 5 feet tall. One of them had like a big machine gun, it felt like. I don't know guns, so. She was just like walking backwards, just keeping an eye on them and just walking really fast. So I connected with her. And then another one of the people who was with us was already in her car and she yelled for us to get in and she drove us out.
And do you understand what it was that they were reacting to? Did they think, like has happened in other places, that there was misinformation that you were Antifa? Or did they understand that this was a protest and they just didn't agree with the message?
There was definitely a lot of misinformation on their side. There was the misinformation that we were outsiders, that we were Antifa, that we were looters, that we were rioters, and not just peaceful families that live in their community with them who wanted to show our solidarity.
G said there's been fallout in her small town. This past week, protesters have received threats. Her personal information was posted online. She's lost friends, but she says she's not deterred.
As I've said multiple times to the people who are with us and to my community, this was just the first step. Clearly, we illuminated a division that we have, but I don't think it's irreparable. I think that we can fix it. We are definitely energized and ready to move and grow from that.
That was Alicia Gee of Bethel, Ohio, talking with NPR's Lulu Garcia Navarro.
All right, that's it for this Sunday edition of Up First. Check back next week as we continue this series with the next episode, The System. And we'll be back again tomorrow with the news you need.